Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Today is the one-year anniversary of the launch of Special Counsel Robert Mueller's investigation into Russian interference in the 2016 election. Yesterday, Senate Judiciary Committee Chairman Chuck Grassley released more than 2,000 pages of transcripts from interviews with Donald Trump Jr. and others involved in the 2016 Trump Tower meeting with a Russian lawyer. Some Democrats have said that the release of the documents signals an end to the committee's investigation. Joining us with his own insights on that and the latest in politics is host of the Political Junkie podcast, Ken Rudin. Welcome back, Ken.
Good morning, Ann.
So what's going on? There are so many different platforms when it comes to this Russian investigation issue. There was the House investigation, the Senate investigation, Robert Mueller's investigation. The House has concluded its. The Senate's doing what and what?
Okay, well, let's stick with the Congress. Let's stick with Congress right now. There were two intelligence committees, and they have two. They're both Republican controlled, but they've come out with two different conclusions. The House Intelligence Committee, which is ostensibly led by Devin Nunes, the Republican from California, has been basically doing what it can to absolve President Trump and really put the onus on the intelligence agencies, the Department of Justice, and Robert Mueller. They agree with President Trump's assessment that it has been a witch hunt, that there is no proof that the Trump campaign has colluded with the Russians. And there's truth to that. I mean, there is no proof, at least no public proof, that the Trump campaign has colluded with the Russians. So that's what the House Intelligence Committee has to say. The Senate Intelligence Committee, which is led by Republican Richard Burr of North Carolina, the Democrat, ranking Democrat is Mark Warner of Virginia, they seem to agree with U.S. intelligence agencies that there was a serious and concerted Russian effort to influence the 2016 election on behalf of President Trump against Donald Trump against Hillary Clinton. So that's the difference between the Senate Intelligence Committee and the House Intelligence Committee. With the Senate Judiciary Committee, they were looking at that meeting at Trump Tower in 2016 among Donald Trump Jr., Paul Manafort, and Jared Kushner. Basically, responding that meeting was held in response to a person who said that the Russians have damaging information on Hillary Clinton. Now, if that's not collusion with Russians, I don't know what is. But that's what the Senate Judiciary Committee has been looking at that meeting, and they've determined that while no damaging dirt on Hillary Clinton was disseminated at that meeting, the fact is that Donald Trump Jr., Manafort, and Kushner did meet with the Russians to get that kind of information.
I thought it was interesting the tone of Donald Jr.'s testimony, what I saw of it. We met. Who wouldn't? Of course we did. I didn't even think of it as being a problem.
Well, there are some people who say that if somebody with ties to the Russian government calls you and says, I have damaging information on your opponent, one might think, well, maybe I'll call the FBI about this. And that's not what Donald Trump Jr. did. He basically, I think the email said that, yeah, you know, let's go for it because I really want to see what you guys have. Now, as it turned out, they didn't have much. But there were so many things about Donald Trump Jr.'s testimony that of course, one may have questions with, like in between certain phone calls, Donald Trump Jr. made calls to a blocked out number that some people think could be to his father. He says he doesn't remember whom he called, which is kind of strains credulity. But his response was kind of casual. He said, "Well, it was really about a law that limits U.S. Abilities to adopt Russian babies," and of course that has been long knocked down by people who've been following what's going on there. But his response has been basically pretty casual and not alarming. And you know, if you're looking for somebody who is not prone to panicking, it seems like Trump Jr. is doing a very good job at that.
There are so many wheels in motion right now in investigations of the Trump administration of one stripe or another. It feels like it, at least. Is the American public worried about this? Is it inured to it? What is your read on that? Ken Rudin?
Well, it depends on whom you're asking. I mean, if you're asking Trump supporters, that they will go with the argument that there's no there, mm-hmm. that it's a witch hunt, that there's just nothing. The fact is that Robert Mueller has come up with, I believe, 16 indictments and already several guilty pleas for lying to the FBI. So you know, a witch hunt is not something that results in 16 indictments. So there is the Mueller investigation out there. But the Democrats are kind of torn about how to deal with it. They, as you see in the candidates in last week's and this week's primaries, with more primaries to come, of course, mm-hmm. they don't know whether to run against. And there are some Democrats who'd like to say that the only answer is impeachment. And there are other Democrats, including Nancy Pelosi and party leaders, said this is irresponsible. It's certainly premature, and it belies whether there's a Democratic message or not. I mean, you know, if you make the case that Hillary Clinton, one of the reasons Hillary Clinton was defeated in 2016, and I don't know if I agree with this, but this is an argument that's out there, is that all she said was basically criticism of Donald Trump and was not offering any alternative. Now, I don't know if I agree with that, but that's what the criticism is. Mm-hmm. The last thing the Democrats want to do is just be seen as an anti-Trump mm-hmm. party. I mean, all these 20 or so Democrats who are already talking or thinking about 2020. I can't believe we're talking about 2020 already.
I know.
But all these Democrats who are thinking about running, they have to come up with a reason to vote for them as opposed to saying we are not Donald Trump. And I think that is part of the Democrats' dilemma.
Well, I haven't noticed a lot of Trump bashing in the primary cycle. Maybe I'm missing something, but what do you think?
Well, certainly not on the Republican side. For all the talk about mm-hmm. all these Republicans who are terrified about what they may face in November with an angry electorate bolstered by enthused Democrats, a lot of Republicans off the record are saying that they are scared to death about what's going to happen in November. And mm-hmm. a lot of them are, of course, fleeing. They're retiring in perhaps record numbers. Mm-hmm. But when you see the candidates who are running, and we saw that in last week's primaries in Indiana and Ohio and West Virginia, they're all pro-Trump. They're trying to outdo each other as far as who is more pro-Trump. And so there seems to be a very fascinating difference here between between Republicans who are talking off the record, saying they're scared to death about what happens in November, and the candidates who are campaigning on an outwardly pro-Trump platform.
Well, is that because they're damned if they're doing, they're damned if they don't?
Well, I think that's a very good point. Look what happened to Jeff Flake in Arizona. Right. He was fairly popular, certainly conservative. Mm-hmm. And when he put out a book, called The Conscience of a Conservative, borrowing a title from Barry Goldwater, but basically a book that criticized Donald Trump, the Republican establishment in Arizona turned against him. Conservatives turned against him. And suddenly he found himself impossible to win re-election this year. And that's why he's retiring. Bob Corker, the senator from Tennessee, also was a critic of President Trump. And he also found himself without a party. And he decided not to run again. So a lot of the Republicans who have criticized Trump are either facing strong opposition in primaries or have bowed out altogether. And that's the dilemma a lot of these Republicans face.
Ohio Governor Kasich said last week or the week before that I didn't leave the party. The party's left me. He still identifies as Republican, but it really is starting to feel like the Republican Party has changed in a kind of, nothing's permanent, but in a fundamental way now.
Oh, I think that's absolutely true. This is Donald Trump's party. Yeah. I think we even though there were so many never Trump Republicans throughout the primaries, the convention, and election in 2016, this is clearly Donald Trump's party. And so when he can't, even if even in the face of surprising defeats or defeats that hurt the Republican Party, like we saw last year, Virginia, last December's special Senate race in Alabama, the congressional upset for the Democrats in Southwest Pennsylvania a month or so ago. This is still Donald Trump's Republican Party. And people like Kasich, I mean, it was interesting how Mary Taylor, running for governor mm-hmm. in last week's primary,
right.
Basically ran away from John Kasich. The talk about whether John Kasich is going to endorse Mike DeWine, his potential successor as governor, that's kind of, not clear what's going to happen right now.
That's so weird.
But Ohio is weirder because Kasich is kind of weird. I mean, whatever you think of, I don't mean Kasich is weird, but the situation is weird because it's one of those rare states where you have a party leader who was so clearly outwardly anti-Trump, and Republicans, you know, being backed by John Kasich may not be the smartest thing for Republicans to do if you're going to try to win over Trump voters in November.
I heard an interesting reference to Kasich the other day. Someone said something like, well, you know, they've got John Kasich and somebody else out there, you know, putting their ducks in a row for a 2020 primary run. And they said, well, look how well he did, you know, when there were 16 running. And, and the person said, yeah, right. What if he's only one or two others running against Trump in a primary? That changes the dynamic. Do you think it does?
Well, I don't know how. I mean, are we talking about how well Kasich did in 2016? Because if memory serves, he won Ohio and nothing
exactly,
else.
Exactly. But that's when he was one of 16. You know, one of whatever diminishing numbers as time went on. But he was one of many. And what if he's the only one, or one of just maybe a couple that opposed Trump in a primary? And you know, next year,
you know, something one on one. I even, you know, I understand the appeal. Look, if he couldn't do well when there were 16 Republicans running against Trump, how well would he do in a one on one against Trump when President Trump himself is still widely admired by Republicans and Republicans who vote in Republican primaries? So it's one thing to talk about the national electorate and what may an enthused Democratic turnout in November. I mean, that's why some people are saying, I think, I don't know if it was Karl Rove or somebody suggested the other day that maybe John Kasich's best bet is to run as an independent, because winning a primary against Donald Trump, with given the fact that he still remains very popular with Republicans, would be a long shot. But again, we still have no idea what Robert Mueller is going to say, when he's going to say it, and you know what we're saying in May may not be the same kind of reality come November.
Evan and Hilliard, you're on the air. Hi, Evan.
Hey there. Earlier, you guys were talking about how, you know, America's been seeing and reacting to the Trump-Russia collusion story. And before I talk, I'm not a Republican. I'm not a fan of Trump. I'm not a Democrat. I'm a crazy libertarian. In general, I think most people are completely numb to it. I mean, this has been going on for 2 years, and you guys said that there was 16 indictments. Indictments don't mean anything. Just ask Bill Clinton. And, I mean, the long run, isn't there new evidence that Obama had spies in the Trump campaign? Like, this is how politics is. It's dirty. We're all numb to this. It's been going on for 2 years, and I don't care. When I hear Russia-Trump collusion, I turn off the radio.
Ken Rudin?
Well, I'm interested, you know, in a lot of what he says. I mean, first of all, you said indictments don't matter, just ask Bill Clinton. I don't remember if Bill Clinton was indicted on anything. He certainly was involved in the Monica Lewinsky impeachment story, but indictment is something else. The fact that Obama may have spies, is that what you said, spies?
Yeah, spies,
Trump camp? That's something I've never read. I mean, look, there's a lot, unfortunately, there's a great Democratic thing with this thing called the internet out there, but there are also a lot of theories being peddled that don't come close to reality. So I do agree with Evan in the sense that I kind of think that people are turned off to it. It's just like, you know, when the Stormy Daniels story broke, and everybody's saying, my goodness, in the past this would have destroyed any other president, let alone presidential candidate. But I think people are yawning. People are just, you know, rolling their eyes, because this is Donald Trump, and we've come to expect this of him, which says a lot about, you know, our faith in government and democratic institutions. But I agree with the argument that a lot of people are not focusing on the Mueller investigation like so many political junkies are.
Evan, thanks a lot for that call. Anybody else out there have a question or comment for my guest, Ken Rudin, host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast? Give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll continue our conversation. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome Welcome back to All Sides. This is your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking politics today with my guest, Ken Rudin. He's a longtime political journalist, host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast. We'll have a link to that on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. If you have a question for Ken Rudin, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@WOSU.org. Since we talked last month, Ken Rudin, Rudy Giuliani's back in the picture, back out in front for the Trump administration. What's your sense about his larger role in all of this?
Well, you know what I love about watching—
He's back.
Exactly. Well, Rudy Giuliani is exactly the same Rudy Giuliani he was as mayor, just as Donald Trump is the same Donald Trump he was when he was a New York businessman. I mean, these guys are larger-than-life figures. The difference is President Trump happens to be the president of the United States. Rudy Giuliani is not, and he has to remember that. But sometimes he'll say things, as you know, when he announced that the President Trump actually paid off Michael Cohen, perhaps reimbursing him for the money that he paid to Stormy Daniels, the $130,000 he paid to as hush money for Stormy Daniels, and then President Trump comes before the cameras and says, well, you know, it'd be nice if Rudy, learned what the truth was, got his facts straight. So sometimes Rudy can get in front of the story. Sometimes it's all about Rudy. And a lot of times he'll say things that the White House staff will just gasp at and say, who gave him the authority to do that? Rudy Giuliani and Donald Trump seem to have this kind of interesting relationship. I wouldn't call them good friends, because I don't think Donald Trump wants anybody to hog the limelight, and Rudy loves to hog the limelight. But he does say some things that could be intemperate. What's the latest thing he said, though? There may be some truth to it in that he says that the Mueller team, Robert Mueller's team, came to him and in conversations and said it is unlikely that there will be any indictment of the president, and they cited the Department of Justice memo, both from 1974 and 2000, when they say that a sitting president cannot be indicted for something he or she did while they were president. And that may be accurate, and Rudy Giuliani, you know, has been making the rounds, making that argument this week.
He says the president's already revealed everything he knows about everything, that it's all out there, which I thought was interesting, considering that he hasn't been deposed or anything.
Of course he hasn't. And of course, and at the same time, although I understand why he's making this case, the president, of course, is not going to agree, most likely not going to agree to a sit-down interview under oath, certainly with Robert Mueller and Robert Mueller's team. And if I were Rudy Giuliani, if I were Jay Sekulow, if I was anybody on the president's legal team, I would advise the same exact thing, because one, Donald Trump has a way of letting his thoughts get in the way of facts. And Donald Trump sometimes can inadvertently say things that can get him in hot water. Now, you're not going to get indicted for lying to the media, for example, saying that I didn't give money to Michael Cohen and I don't know anything about this. Mm-hmm. You can say whatever you want to the media and lie before the media if that's the case. But you can't lie to Robert Mueller, especially if you're under oath. And that is a fear that the Trump legal team unanimously shares. And I think in that sense, Giuliani's advice is spot on.
Some of the week's news was filled with dire reports from Gaza, where Palestinians were protesting the move of the U.S. embassy in Israel to Jerusalem. And a Fox News host said that President Trump's decision to move the U.S. embassy in Israel from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem is filled with biblical significance. Now, I remember hearing this a few months ago, and I'm just wondering, is this a real thing, Ken Rudin? Do people really see this as fulfilling some kind of biblical prophecy?
Actually, I do. I think one of the reasons the evangelical Christian community is so enamored with Israel, not so much about Jews, but Israel, and I think it's because in this way of thinking that the return of Jesus Christ is coming, and it's coming in Jerusalem. I always felt that one of the reasons the evangelical community was so gung-ho on Israel and why Donald Trump is so gung-ho on Israel is because of the biblical significance of what Israel represents, especially with another resurrection and things like that. So So, but you have to know, I think, look, presidents in the past have always give lip service to moving the embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, but they don't do it because they haven't done it because they didn't do it because there are repercussions. And while, I mean, there's so many people at fault for this, for what's going on in Gaza, and the thought of, I mean, at least 60 people killed, thousands injured. I mean, you do have people, you do have Hamas, who, you know, people in Gaza saying, you know, run the border, climb over the fences because the Israelis are retreating. And so many Palestinians have done that and they were gunned down. Now, the irresponsibility of Hamas trying to use it for propaganda purposes is disgraceful. I mean, you know, the fact that, you know, children have been killed and Hamas is showing their pictures everywhere, and it's a great propaganda tool. But having said that, I mean, the fact is Israelis are just, it's like target practice. They're just shooting thousands of people with no end in sight. So is it because the U.S. moved its embassy? I'd have to say yes. Maybe Hamas is using the Israeli embassy move as an excuse, but there's certainly a connection between the moving of the embassy and the violence in Gaza, and there's no question about that. And, I mean, I don't know how it ends. I don't know how you stop it. The point is not pointing out who's at fault, because it seems like everybody's at fault here, but this... As somebody said, this just cannot go on. You just can't have the wanton just slaughter of people, and yet it just continues to go on.
You know, what about the optics of Ivanka Trump kind of glowing in the limelight of the celebration in Jerusalem while the protesters were being shot at the border? Is that really fair to her, though?
Yeah, well, look, the fact that Jared Kushner is talking, I mean, Jared Kushner and Ivanka Trump are talking about what a glorious day this is. And then you have a Dallas pastor who's saying these great things about moving the embassy when this same pastor, Robert Jeffers, has said things about Mormons and Jews that are basically, you know, hate speech. Right. I mean, a lot of people think it's hate speech. So so you have all these. There is a real contradiction when you're looking at Kushner talking about, well, the protesters are part of the problem, and what Netanyahu and Trump are doing is really to bring peace, when nobody outside of the Israeli government or the White House seem to think that this is going to lead to peace. I think it is fair to single them out and saying that this is not part of what reality is all about.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest is Ken Rudin. We're talking politics. He's the host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast. He joins us once a month. So if you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Carissa in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi.
Hi.
Go ahead.
All right. Okay, so my question is...
Carissa's very happy this morning.
I know.
It's an early morning for me. I'm not usually up this early.
Well, thanks for getting
So I want to ask, I know kind of we see that Trump ran on a really successful economic populist agenda in 2016. And I'm wondering how much of that we're seeing, like, both in Republican and in Democratic primaries. You're going into 18 and... then into the midterms as well.
Unfortunately, I missed the beginning of what Carissa was saying. What were you saying about 2016? I missed it. I'm sorry.
Oh, the economic populist agenda that Trump ran on.
Yes, right. Will we see that among Democrats? Will they be targeting those blue-collar workers that maybe crossed over or didn't vote at all?
Well, you know, remember, it wasn't only Donald Trump who had an economic populist message in 2016. It was Bernie Sanders as well. These were, even though they were not on the same page when it came to a lot of policies, they were in similar ways talking about economic fairness and, you know, the big corporate the bad guys were the big corporations who were taking all the profits. So they both ran as outsiders. The economic message, I think, worked in many ways in Donald Trump's favor, in the fact that so many jobs were shipped overseas, that is people in Ohio. I mean, Sherrod Brown may be the first one to agree with this, like that you need tariffs and you need protectionist trade policies to make things fairer for the American people. I think Democrats are learning it as well. We saw yesterday, remarkably, in yesterday's primaries in Pennsylvania and also in Idaho and Nebraska and elsewhere, where economic progressives talking about populist moves on the economy, on trade, on issues like that, won a lot of the primaries. It was a Democratic establishment that took it on the head yesterday, Tuesday, mm-hmm. in the primaries in those states. It was the progressives that seemed to carry the day, saying that we need fairness, and we certainly didn't get it. We weren't going to get it under a Hillary Clinton presidency, and we may not be getting it under a Donald Trump presidency either. But that economic message, I think, resonates in both parties. We saw it in 2016 with the Republicans and Donald Trump's election. We may be seeing it in 2018 as well with the Democrats, say, you know, coming up with their own prescription for the economic woes.
Two members of the Democratic Socialists of America won out in Pennsylvania State House primaries.
Yeah, absolutely, and a lot of women have won as well. That's but also, another, yep. it's not only. I mean, look, the year of the women, which is such a tired cliche that we've been saying it. We said it in 1972. We said it in certainly 1984 with Geraldine Ferraro and all that stuff. But it seems real. We're talking about over 1,000 female congressional mm-hmm. candidates this year, and I mean, look, you kind of knew that was coming on January 21st, 2017, mm-hmm. The day after the presidential inauguration, when the women's marches around the country took forth, and so many women came forward to run as candidates. But it was just interesting, especially in Pennsylvania, that there was a Bernie Sanders supporter who never ran for office before, defeated the incumbent lieutenant governor in the Democratic primary on Tuesday because the Bernie voters rallied around him. In Nebraska, there was a Bernie supporter. Let me just say, there's a former Democratic congressman, a conservative, who was hoping to get his seat back in Nebraska, defeated by a female, an outsider candidate, a woman mm-hmm. who was just far more progressive than the former congressman. So, you know, we talk about how the Republicans were angry at the Obama administration after 8 years in 2016. It seems like a lot of Democrats are angry at the Democratic establishment in 2018. The question is whether they are going to run so far to the left that they may turn off centrists and moderates. But clearly they are energized, an energized force coming into November.
I guess, I mean, the primaries is one thing. The general is going to be another thing. There are so many women running in tough seats against Republican incumbents. It's not likely that a lot of them are going to show up, you know, afterward. But the question then is 2019, 2020, does it endure?
Well, let's see if it endures. Look, that's a great question. Let's see if it endures into November. We're talking about 5-6 months from now. Because mm-hmm. remember, for example, in Pennsylvania, there are 18 congressional districts, and the number of women who are in Congress in Pennsylvania as of now is zero. And now we're talking about the Democrats nominated 7 women on Tuesday. 4 of them could actually win. So we're talking about perhaps record number of women represented in Congress come 2019. And if the Democrats are going to win the House, and they could very well do that, they need a net pickup of 23 seats. In states like Pennsylvania, where they redrew the map from the old Republican redistricting gerrymandering maps, look no further than Pennsylvania, where the Democrats could make their biggest gains. So, Look, whether it's sustained past 2019 and 2020, whether it imperils Donald Trump's reelection, that's another conversation. Mm. Let's see what happens for November right now. And right now, the Democrats seem to be moving on the right track, although Trump's numbers have increased in the past couple of weeks, mm-hmm. perhaps because of the tax bill, perhaps because of the prospect of peace with North Korea. So it's going to, you know, it's not going to be a cakewalk. Everybody says the Democrats are assured of winning the House back in 2018. Nothing is assured. I mean, look, we couldn't predict the day of 2016, what was going to happen that day. Mm. We're certainly not going to make predictions in May. But boy, this is going to be a tough. This is going to be a fascinating race to watch.
You're getting a sense that the tax bill has had that much of an impact on rank and file voters?
No, I don't. But the Republicans are going to spend millions of dollars on trying to make that case. I mean, ultimately, I think it's far less. Look, it's great for the corporations, and I think it's great for the rich. But the Republicans are trying to make the case that, you know, this is not a do-nothing Republican Congress. It changed, you know, the tax laws that more and more Americans are getting more money in their pockets. And there is some indication that many have benefited from it. I don't think it's nearly as large as the Trump tried to argue mm-hmm. when they were debating that bill, but the Republican machine is going to spend a lot of money trying to convince voters or make the case that to voters that it did make a difference.
You know, you made the point earlier on that the Democrats are going to have to run for something, not against something. But, you know, in the meantime, the Trump administration has dismantled a lot of things that, you know, came before it in the administration before it. And it's sort of kind of, you know, knocked a few of the bolts out, to say the least, of the Affordable Care Act. It's this shadow of its former self. But they haven't replaced it with anything. He said it was going to be something bigger and better. Is that going to play a role in any of this?
Well, I think Republicans have finally come to the realization that they're not going to completely remove the Affordable Care Act from law. And in some cases, I think a lot of people feel that it is successful. But in other issues where the Trump administration seems determined to just undo everything that President Obama did, get rid of the legacy completely, especially on immigration and climate change. There seems to be, especially on the environment, I think of what's going on with Scott Pruitt and the EPA
right.
and all the controversies over that. There is an argument to be made that the swamp is still far from being drained. It's just being replaced from Obama people or career people to Trump people. And I think that seems to be what seems to be enraging many voters, that nobody's not. I mean, climate change may be real, and dirty air is really a problem, and you know, all the things that seems like the American people wanted: clean air, clean water, safe foods, things like that. That could very well be a very surprising issue that comes to fore by the fall.
We're going to continue our talk of politics today with the host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast, Ken Rudin. So stay with us. Bring your questions, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. My guest is the host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast, Ken Rudin. He joins us one Thursday a month to talk politics. If you have a question or comment for Ken Rudin, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Ken, we have a question from Lucia on Twitter. She says, how would Ken characterize chatter outside Ohio about the Brown-Renacci Senate race?
Well, it's you know, obviously it's Sherrod Brown seeking a third term for the Senate. He's one of 10 Democrats seeking re-election to the Senate in states that Donald Trump won. So we've established that the Republicans did very well in 2016 in states like Ohio. Can Sherrod Brown win another term? My guess is he will, but you know, I mean, who knows what's going to happen? I kind of think that Renacci, the Republican Party, didn't seem to have its act together when they seemed to anoint Mr. Mandel.
Josh Mandel.
Josh Mandel, you know, the state treasurer, you know, who was seeking the Senate seat. I never thought he was a good candidate. I didn't think he was going to win 6 years ago, and I didn't think he was going to win this time. Renacci appeals to more of the conservative element of the Republican Party. But when I looked at the primary results, Renacci's win in the primary against somebody who really wasn't well-known, mm-hmm. although he was well-funded, was less impressive than I expected. I think, you know, it seems like it could be very... I think the real interesting thing in Ohio is the gubernatorial race, mm-hmm. but I think Sherrod Brown does hold on for another term. I think the Republicans are going to look at other more vulnerable Democrats like Joe Donnelly in Indiana, for example, than they will against Sherrod Brown. But it's certainly going to be a race to watch. My money, if I had money, but if I had money, I would probably put it on Sherrod Brown.
President Trump has targeted Democrat Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia in the drive to protect the GOP Senate majority. Manchin's a pretty friendly Democrat. Is this a sign of that struggle ahead?
Well, the problem with Joe Manchin is a problem with, like, Joe Donnelly and the problem with John Tester in Montana and Heidi Heitkamp in North Dakota, in that they are nominally kind of centrist, if not leaning conservative Democrats, mm-hmm. In a party that's moving further to the left in states that are moving further to the right. So the problem with Joe, I mean, the reason Joe Manchin is targeted is because Donald Trump, I think his best state may have been West Virginia, which is fascinating to me.
Yeah.
He beat Hillary Clinton by 42 percentage points. I mean, that is a monster of a landslide. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't have to be that old to remember West Virginia, that a Republican could never win in right. West Virginia. Now it looks like Democrats could never win. So Manchin is in a state where Donald Trump won overwhelmingly. And so you can see, like, he supports Gina Haspel's nomination for CIA director. I mean, he'll vote for a mm-hmm. lot of Trump initiatives. What the Republicans were terrified about was the fact that Don Blankenship, a very controversial former mine right. Owner, was going to be the Republican nominee, and he could be another Roy Moore in the sense that he could have taken a possible Republican victory the way Roy Moore had a chance in Alabama but threw it away because of a very controversial past. So Blankenship is not the Republican nominee there, but Manchin is running is a conservative, knows he you know, he has a struggle to win in a very pro-Trump state. That's going to be a tough race for him to win. I think he's a good candidate. I think he's a much better candidate than the Republican nominee, Attorney General Patrick Morrisey, who I've watched him campaign during the primary. Not impressive at all, but very pro-Trump, very conservative. The fact that he was a former lobbyist and a former congressional candidate in New Jersey, it probably doesn't help his chances in West Virginia that much. But it's going to be a tough race. Joe Manchin is fighting a tide that even his personal popularity and his ability to vote across party lines may not save him. That's a tough race. It's going to be a very important race to watch.
You know, correct me if I'm wrong. You know, unlike in Ohio the week before, more Democrats than Republicans turned out in Pennsylvania primaries. What do you make of that? And what do you make of the lack of turnout in Ohio? I mean, it was pretty typical. You would have thought you'd see some kind of uptick in after 2016.
You know something? I thought of that. It was interesting. Last week, and not 2 days ago, but the week before that, mm-hmm. when Ohio and Indiana and West Virginia and the other states yep. voted, all the story was about the Republican vote and the Republican turnout. And, you know, I mean, I thought that Cordray's victory over Kucinich was far bigger than I expected.
Right.
So that was impressive. But the fact that far more Republicans voted in Ohio was very interesting, because you keep hearing about the Democratic enthusiasm, the Democratic momentum, and Republicans are discouraged, especially in a state like Ohio, where its leading Republican is a never-Trumper. So I thought it was interesting all those Republicans who turned out. Tuesday mm-hmm. in Pennsylvania was the opposite. 100,000 yeah. more Democrats turned out, and the only big race there was for lieutenant governor, which is not about to get anybody excited and anything. But it looks like that, I mean, every state is different, and, you mm-hmm. know, all politics is local, as somebody mm-hmm. who famously once said. That was Tip O'Neill. But it seemed like yesterday, Tuesday, the focus was all about the Democrats and how the progressive wing of the party yeah. Is beating back the establishment wing. Whereas the week before that, all the talk was on the Republican side and whether the, whether it, it suffice to be pro-Trump or somebody who could just win in November. So it's just, I think every state is different. I think we'll see, you know, for, as we get closer and closer to other states, we'll see what happens in California, for example, on June 5th. Will a Republican even make the, you know, they have the, this jungle primary in California where all candidates, regardless of party, run on the same ballot. And it's very possible that in the race for the Senate seat that's held by Dianne Feinstein and the race for governor where Jerry Brown is retiring mm-hmm. after 400 years as governor, it seems like Republicans may not even make the runoff. They may not even make the final two. So in some states, the Republicans have this great excitement, as we saw 2 weeks ago in West Virginia and Ohio and elsewhere. And in some states like California, my goodness, the Republicans may not even be a factor in November.
We have a question from Dell on Twitter. He asks, how long since the last notable departure from the White House and who might be next to go? I can't.
Well, wow. I mean, everybody, the top of everybody's list has to be Scott Pruitt, the embattled administrator of the EPA.
But that's kind of quieted down, though, hasn't it?
No. He's under tons. There are 12 federal investigations going on right now about his spending
corrected.
And management decisions. No, it's just quiet because the headlines are kind of old already. I mean, it's one thing to be a climate change denier, and that's fine because Donald Trump ran on that. I think he once said that climate change is a hoax. I think he's backed down.
Perpetrated by the Chinese, by the way, but yeah.
Right, exactly. And Scott Pruitt, when he was Attorney General of Oklahoma, sued the EPA over and over again. So he's never been a fan of the EPA. But with him, it's management decision. The fact that he rented a condo for $50 a night from the wife of a lobbyist who testifies before the Environmental Protection Agency. Is that not the swamp? I mean,
it's a no-brainer.
That's what I think. And then he put in a $43,000 soundproof phone booth in his office,
which is just weird.
And then when he travels to restaurants, he has sirens and lights flashing in Washington. This is the last thing Donald Trump wants is a controversy that is not, you know, his own doing. And I'm surprised that Pruitt, I think the only reason Pruitt has lasted this long is because Democrats are demanding he gets fired.
Yeah.
And you know that Donald Trump is not going to accede to what Democrats are demanding. But Pruitt has to be the next to go. I'm surprised he's not the first to go.
Mm. You know, I wanted to talk about Mike Pence. Things are popping up now in the news that he's being accused of kind of forging a second power base in the administration. I read that he's filling a void because the White House has not yet crafted a strategy for the midterms. So that's kind of asking you two questions at the same time. First of all, Mike Pence, not surprising that he's grooming and preparing, I don't know how to say it, just grooming the garden for his own political ambitions to grow.
Well, let's pass 2020 first, but you're absolutely right. I mean, look, Mike Pence, one of the reasons Trump picked Pence as his running mate, and the reason the conservative community liked it so much is Pence, when it comes to conservative philosophy, he's the real deal. He's been a conservative leader as governor of Indiana, and before that, in his many years in Congress. He is certainly very, very conservative, but at least he's more... I think Republicans understand his philosophy more than they do Donald Trump, even though some Republicans are wild about him. There's some states that Donald Trump would not be able to campaign in without being, without being booed and heckled and all these things. Trump, I think Pence fits in with many more Republicans much more easily. I think it's silly to talk about him being, a rival for power. There was one crazy report that was going on for a while that there was going to be a Pence and Nikki Haley ticket in 2020 to challenge Donald Trump. I mean, the stories are just, look, I guess political reporters are just lonely and they need to come up with cockamamie stories. And that was crazy. It was always those kind of things that how you know, Obama was going to dump Joe Biden and pick Hillary Clinton, and how Nixon was going to dump Agnew. I mean, these stories go on forever and ever. But anyway, the point is Mike Pence is an asset, a quiet asset to the president when it comes to conservative philosophy and conservative audiences. Mm-hmm. And while 2024 is a long way away, although, believe it or not, Scott Pruitt is reportedly looking at 2024, Pence seems to be doing everything right. You know, it's very rare that you have a vice president like a Dick Cheney, who clearly had no interest in succeeding his boss or running for president. Mike Pence is certainly not in the Dick Cheney kind of Republican vice president.
But the idea that he's filling a void because the White House has not yet crafted a strategy for the midterms, that just seems impossible to believe that they don't have a strategy for the midterms. We're in the midterms.
Yeah, and they definitely have a strategy. I mean, basically, I think he's a very, you know, as you're asking this question, I think the more and more I'm thinking of it, it's interesting. I know that there were a lot of states in 2012, for example, in 2016, 2014, where Hillary Clinton couldn't go and Barack Obama couldn't go, but Elizabeth Warren went because she really excited the crowd. I think Mike Pence is not Mr. Excitement, but when you think of his debate example, for example, VP debate against Tim Kaine, most people, I think that Pence won that debate. He can be very calm and reassuring, and I think that's what the Republican Party needs right now, given the crazy headlines you're seeing every day about Trump and Russia and Robert Mueller.
Margaret in Grandview, you're on the air with Ken Rudin. Hi, Margaret.
Hello. I wanted to mention this that the Democrats might use when they're campaigning. It doesn't seem to come up much, but of the scientists and our concerns about climate change and all of the science involved, only 6% of the Republicans believe are scientists. And then there's a larger part that are Republicans, but they're only 6% of Republicans. So, and they are always downgrading that.
I'm not sure I understand, Margaret, what you mean, that only 6% of Republicans are scientists.
That's what they are. Only 6% of them go into the scientists, according to the Pew poll. You can look it up, and you don't need to bring it on the air, but it's a huge thing.
Okay.
Because climate change is changing everything.
Ken Rudin, you mentioned earlier that you think climate change is going to be an issue.
Well, I do think it's an issue, and I think it will continue to be an issue. I think there's a bigger point. I think what Margaret is really saying, though, is that many Republican voters, by and large, forget about how many become scientists, but clearly the Republican Party, even the Republican Party, though, polls will show that a majority of Republican voters do think that climate change is real, even though you have an administration that basically questions the results from these scientists, because they'll say there's conflicting evidence and things like that. It's disappointing to me. Climate change is one of those things where it should not be D's versus R's. It should be the fact that the planet is in danger and we need to take action on it. And it shouldn't be a Democrat or Republican issue, but clearly it's become that. So polls do show that more and more, I mean, even though Republicans themselves do not go in the science department to become these climate scientists and talk about, you know, ozone layers and things like that, I think more and more Republicans are coming around to the fact that this is a serious problem.
Just we only have a couple minutes left, Ken Rudin, but I wanted to get your feedback on what's going on over this dissing of John McCain, Arizona Senator John McCain. He's got brain cancer. You know, who knows if he's going to be back, but be that as it may, there have been some derogatory comments from Congress, from a member of Congress, and also from inside the administration. There were leaks associated with that. But what do you think? What's going on?
Well, it's really heartbreaking. I mean, the fact is, I mean, here's a story that John McCain said because of having been tortured as a prisoner during the Vietnam War in the 1970s, he opposes Gina Haspel's nomination to be the next head of the CIA because she has condoned or seemingly condoned, hasn't criticized the torture treatments, the waterboarding of terrorist suspects in the past. So he says no, we have to vote against her. And then this woman, Kelly Langer, maybe I'm forgetting her name right now.
Yeah, an aide. Yeah.
An aide, you know, in the communications department, the White House said, well, it doesn't really matter what McCain has to say because he's dying. He's dying anyway, so it doesn't matter. And that was, you know, it was, actually, some people reported that as a joke that flopped. The thought of that being a joke is beyond, you know.
Yeah, right.
Here's what bugs me about this. And whatever you think about John McCain, here's the thing. And I don't want to take up too much time about this. But for the White House and all the Republicans to go ballistic when Michelle Wolf said some off-color jokes at the White House Correspondents' Dinner, and some of them did cross a line, but she's a comedian. She was paid to do that. To have somebody in the administration not only talk about the fact that John McCain is dying, he's going to die soon, but no apology, no backing down, no regrets, that breaks my heart. It's very sad.
Ken Rudin, thank you so much for joining us today. As usual, always appreciate your time.
Did an hour go by already? Thanks a lot.
It flies when you're having fun. Thanks, Ken Rudin.
Thanks, Ann.
Host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast. We'll have a link to that on our website at WOSU.org. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.